All right. 21:5. Let's go there. Proverbs 21:5, and then we will jump into Exodus after this. And do some fun stuff. Somebody read that when you get there. 21:5. All right, the plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage. What's the idea there? The plans of the diligent versus part B, just this idea of hastiness versus diligence. What's the contrast here between these two individuals?
Slow and steady word versus trying to make a quick buck.
Yeah, maybe in that regards, you certainly see this idea of poverty, so slow and steady versus trying to make quick money. Take it outside of maybe just financial poverty. What would it look like just to have life poverty? What's the contrast there?
I think it's just the amount of time
you dedicate to things. Yeah, right? With purposeness. Purposeness? That's not a word. Purposefulness? That's not a word either, is it? Purposefulness? That sounds way better. Okay, see? It's like purpose, but different. Just purpose. Thank you, Jane. Appreciate you bringing wisdom. The idea would be those that are intentional about their life direction are going to wind up, more likely than not, hitting that mark one day. Those that just kind of float by and are like vessels at sea without an anchor, they're going to get pushed around by every wind and wave and end up where they end up because there's no purpose in going there. Heard a story a long time ago. A guy was on a road trip with a bunch of guys, and they got in a car, typical college students, and dude, road trip, right? They get in a car, and they start driving, and it's, driven through the night, and they hit a gas station at 6 in the morning and have no idea where they are. They stop in the gas station, and they ask the owner for directions. This is like pre-GPS, like my day, college students, right? And they ask the owner of the gas station, hey, we're trying to go somewhere. We don't know where we are. And the guy said, the owner of the gas station says, well, where are you trying to go? And the guy said, we don't know. And he said, well, then does it really matter where you are? Like, well, if you're purposeless in your destination, then it doesn't really matter where you are because you're not really going anywhere anyway. You're driving in circles. So, great. You drove 12 hours through the night and you accomplished your goal, right? And sometimes life can get that way if we don't have goals and aspirations. There's no direction to where we're going. Jeff Kruger, to this day, will tell you a story about a guy that changed his life forever that pushed on this area of his life. Okay, Jeff is our, I don't know what we call him, our ops director. What do we call him, Jane? Is that right? He oversees a couple departments in the well, creative, and was over finance at one point, oversees all the facility guys, and he's a brilliant guy with an MBA. But early on in life, he had a boss that just said, man, Jeff, where do you see yourself in, 15 years? And Jeff was like, well, I want to be a godly guy. Your typical churchy, godly person answer, right? And he gave the right answer. And he's like, no, like deeper than that. Like, where specifically, where do you want to end up in 15 years? What do you see yourself doing? He's like, well, I want to be married. I'd like to have some kids. I'd like to have, gotten an MBA by that point in my life. And he started physically writing down stuff. And the guy said, okay, in 5 years, where do you need to be there in 15 years? Okay, in 3 years. Okay, then the next 6 months. And he made Jeff literally to like painfully chart out, what is your life going to look like? Like if you want to be married with children and own a home or have an MBA or be a pastor or work at, what is that going to take to do that? Like what life aspirations do you have and what do you need to do tomorrow to get there, right? And some days it's like, well, nothing. But, if I'm going to get my MBA, then I probably need to finish school, right? I need to get my undergrad. And then I need to work towards these things. I need to get jobs in these areas. And he said for Jeff, it completely changed his worldview, right? In terms of like every day. So literally, he'll sit on the couch at night and think, do I want to watch TV or do I want to read this book? And some nights it's, I want to watch TV. But he knows, man, that's not purposeful in getting to me where I want to go. So some nights he chooses to read a book about this, that, and the other thing because that's where he wants to go. The most difficult assignment I ever did in our residency program is I had to do a life map. Okay, from when I was 21, 22 when I went through residency till 70, and I had to map out my entire life. Like, oh my gosh, I don't know where I'm going to be next week. 70? Like, I have no idea. Now, honestly, now that I'm 38 and I look back on that, most of it is completely wrong, but I was purposefully going somewhere, right? I never saw a ton of the things coming that were coming, right? Fresno was kind of on the radar, but boy, I assure you, off the front wasn't. I had no idea that I'd be leading a nonprofit. I had no idea that, you know, the details of my life, but I had to be intentional about, well, where do I want to go? Well, I need to finish my undergrad, which I had done. I want to go to seminary and get this degree, and then I want to go work in a church and do these types of things, and I had to write those things down. So the question is for you guys, have you thought about that? Have you put an idea of where do I want my life to be long term? What do I want to be doing? Am I doing right now? Like some of you are probably in career paths. You're like, man, I love what I do, and I want to do this for 50 years in some form or fashion. Okay, some of you obviously with seminary and things like that have been forced to kind of make those decisions in a good way. You've already thought about those. Maybe some of you have never thought about that. You're in the midst of school. And you're like, man, I don't know. I'm not sure. Okay, that's okay too. But to begin to diligently move towards something, and that something may be, listen, I know I need to finish school. Okay, right now, that's priority. Or I know this is the career field. Like, what do I need to do to begin to open those doors, right? Or to allow God to open those doors. And to think purposefully about your life, okay? More often than not, those are the type of people that I see succeed. And oftentimes they're wrong, and they'll beat their head against doors that God's closed, but that's okay. At least they're moving, right? You've heard the old saying that God doesn't move parked cars, right? You've got to be intentional, and then God will tend to open doors in the process, okay? So think about that from that standpoint, and think about, man, have you done that? Do you have some goals written down? Do you have ideas and dreams that you want to see fulfilled? And know that those just can't be pie in the sky, daydream type things. You're going to have to put shoe leather to those and begin to move forward in some capacity to see those things achieved, all right? So, cool. Something for all of us to ponder, okay? Convicting in a lot of ways, but I think will help most of us, okay? Don't be the one that is led to poverty life-wise because of a lack of planning on your part, all right? Thoughts on that? I'm not decided. Maybe. We have in years past. This Jared has been the one that's pushed that. So, yeah, you may. It won't be the same type of life map we did, but yeah, there. I will talk to him more about that, but potentially. It's a hard assignment, but some of you may live longer than that. So, I plan to die at 70, so I just, yeah, I'm going to get hit by a car or something. So, actually, I've already been hit by two cars, but that's all right. That's another story. Yeah, yeah. Plan your morbid death. I'm going to go out in flames. All right. Exodus, shall we? Fun stuff. Anna Sally, will you pray for us this morning as we dive into chapter 19 and 20, the Ten Commandments and all that fun stuff? Thanks. Amen. All right. So we have seen out of Egypt, right? God has brought this people out. We've seen the crises. Dang it. Stupid English. I don't know. Of Moses. We have seen him go through many a crisis. That's a word. That I'm positive of. Okay. So we saw 15 through kind of chapter 18, the issues of water and food and water and safety. We saw Jethro kind of come in and save the day, offer Moses great leadership counsel to diligently basically plan and organize his people in such a way that he's not going to burn out, they're not going to burn out, and that's kind of where we left things last Thursday, Friday. Today now, we're going to get into the second half of the book of Exodus, which is all about the giving of the law and the building of this building in the middle of nowhere, right? The tabernacle. This is going to be the Israelites' place of worship where they're going to interact with God until the building of the temple. Okay, so this is the first time we've seen such an object built. God is going to spend almost half the book giving blueprints to a design of a building from chapter 25 to 40 with a couple little historical blips in between. It's all about the tabernacle. Okay, so we'll take a look at that as well. All right, so 19, we talked a little bit about this introduction of the law. We talked about this new type of covenant. You guys remember last Friday? The covenants that we've seen before in Scripture, what were those called? What type of covenant? Unilateral, right? A one-way covenant between God, the superior, and the lesser, saying, I will do these things, and it's unconditional, right? Same type of covenant we give on the altar. I will do these things. I promise and I vow myself to do these things. This one is different. You guys remember the name of this one, what type of covenant it was? suzerain vassal. It's a fancy word for saying, listen, this is between a king and a vassal. It's between a superior and a lesser, same idea, but it's contractually bound, okay? The superior, in this case God, says, I am going to enact this covenant with you. These are the terms. I promise to do these things based on who I am, and in return, you will do these things. And if this give and take works, these will be the end results, okay? Blessing, helpfulness, a symbiotic relation, that type of thing. That's exactly what God's doing. This type of contract was very normative in this day, okay, for a king and his vassals to set up contracts like this with an S. I failed spelling in fifth grade. Why do you ask me such hard questions? S-U-Z-E-R-I-A-N, suzerain, S-U-Z-E-R-I-A-N, something like that, vassal, V-A-S-S-A-L or E-O, one of those. It's got a vowel in there. Pick whatever one you like. I'm not allowed to say this anymore because I said it in Israel and everyone said that's so wrong. But in Hebrew, they spell things like 20 different ways. It's bizarre because we don't have the transliteration like exact in English. So you can spell a town like Chorazin with a C-H. You can spell it with a K. You can spell it with, I think they spell it other ways. But then they say, no, spelling is actually very important. I'm like, well, then why on one sign does it say C-H-O-R and another one says K-O-R? Like, anyway, so I liked Hebrew because I thought, man, it's like, left up to your own interpretation. How would you like to spell this word? Oh, that's right. I'm like, yes, finally. So, okay. So 19, we got the preamble kind of to what's coming. We're going to see the parties that are involved. You see God in the midst of 19. We already kind of looked at a portion of this. Begin to set this up. He talks about how he bore Israel on eagle's wings, right? How he cared for them. And he reminds them who he is. Verse 5, he talks about if they will keep this covenant, that they will be his own special treasure. That's literally like God's pet name for Israel, which is pretty cool, right? You shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation to me. You're going to be the go-between between me and the rest of the world so that they know me, right? And in the literally the belly button of the world, Israel is the land bridge between Asia, Africa, and Europe. And if you want to go anywhere from one continent to another, you have to go through Israel. Okay, so it's fitting that God would pick this people and put them in this land to say, listen, anybody that wants to go anywhere is going to have to come through you, and as a result, they're going to get introduced to me. That is your role, okay, in life. And obviously, Peter calls us the priesthood of believers, the Gentiles, ultimately, and we take on that role in form, in a sense. We don't take it away from Israel, but we play that role as well, okay? So 19, he kind of gives the preamble to this. He tells Moses, look, you're going to go up the hill. 3 days you're going to spend down here. Make sure the people are ready. He makes them prepare their hearts for 3 days to get ready to hear the law and for Moses to bring the Ten Commandments down the hill. Okay, very serious day. There's thunder, there's lightning. I mean, it's a pretty big deal. And he wants to make sure that the people understand why God is giving the laws. Okay, so in chapter 20, let's begin to look at this. Right, we're going to start with the Ten Commandments, the first 10. Which, in a sense, are a Cliff Notes version of the law, okay? There's 613 commandments in total given here and in Deuteronomy, okay? So we don't see them all yet, but we will by the time this whole thing is unfolded. 613, okay? And there's a bunch of do's, and there's a bunch of do not do's, okay? Or don'ts, however you want to describe this, okay? So the Ten Commandments literally serve as kind of a life map, as an overview of all the laws, okay? And then there's two verses throughout all of Scripture that they will even boil down and say, a Jew will, and say, this is the summary statement of the law. Okay, and we'll look at those later on as we roll through. Okay, but those were important as well. Okay, so 20, verse 2, verse 1 rather, let's pick up there, Pete, if you will, and let's see now the giving of the Ten Commandments.
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery.
Now, why would God start there before he gives the Ten Commandments? Again, thinking of the suzerain vassal type language. What is he doing? This is who I am, and this is what I have done for you, right? I am the guy in charge. I am the authority. I am the king, okay? And because I love you, I've done these things, okay? So I am not an evil king. I am not putting laws on you that are unfair, okay? And we'll talk about the purpose of these laws here in just a second. But he's establishing his role in this, okay? So here's our first commandment in verse 3. Okay, so God is a jealous God, right? In a positive way, we see that God says, it's me and me alone, okay? By the way, the first four commandments deal with Israel's relationship to God. The last six deal with their relationship with each other and anyone else around them. Okay, so the first four are vertical. The last six are horizontal. Okay, so they're kind of cool in the way that they work out. And four kind of works between almost is a both and. Okay, so number one, we're going to talk about your religious life. Okay, and each one of these kind of have a cool, just category that they fit in. And as you look back and kind of step back from the Ten Commandments as a whole, they're really a great code for life. Okay, so what is your religious life going to look like? You're going to worship me, and you're going to worship me alone. Okay, no other gods before me. Okay, number two, keep going, Pete.
You shall not make yourself a carved image or anything or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water underneath under the earth.
Okay, so no idols, right? You're going to worship me. You're going to worship me alone. You're not going to make an image of me. You're not going to worship anything other than me in some physical form, okay? What's the first thing that Israel does in Exodus 33? They get all these laws. Moses goes up the hill. Aaron's like lonely and freaking out, and the people are scared because Moses is gone, and what do? They make an image. They make a golden image in the form of a calf, and they worship it, right? It seems odd to us, like that would be their knee-jerk reaction, right? But that there's a reason that God's telling them this. You are used to worshiping in a place that they worship things. They make figurines and say, that is God, that is God, that is God. And they're like, okay, well, if we want to appease God and we want rain or we want food or we want water, all the stuff that we don't have, then we better build this God and worship it, then that'll be appeased and it'll bring us the things that we need. Okay, so it's they're trying to meet the most basic of needs. God is saying, no, I will meet those needs. And as a demonstration that you believe in me and me alone, don't build these things, okay? So, religion, worship, okay? Number three, look at, verse 5, keep going, and this is the explanation as to why.
You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God and the jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who
all right, so God talks about here being a jealous God, okay? And it's not jealous, he's not jealous of them and that he doesn't want them to worship other gods because he is somehow like a snotty 16-year-old girlfriend and doesn't want her, you know, boyfriend talking to other people. This is I am jealous for you. I want all of your affections. It's the reason why my wife would say, no, you can't have another wife. I want all of you. I don't want to be first among many. I want to be first among one. I am your only. Right, that's the idea. Okay, this is a beautiful covenant relationship. Okay, in the type of God who, by the way, verse 6 shows loving kindness to thousands of generations. Right, that's kind of the idea behind those words. Okay, now verse 7. Let's see commandment 4. Commandment 3, verse 7. Okay, so what does that mean, to take God's name in vain? Now, from Texas, that meant something completely different, right? That was, you know, saying what we all think of, right? But that's not what it means to take God's name in vain. What does that mean in context here?
Does it mean to discredit
him? Exactly, okay? Which would be something like, I swear by God to do X, Y, Z, and then you don't do X, Y, and Z, and then what happens? You just took God's name in vain. You defamed him because of something you attached his character to, right? God will say in Scripture, I have no one to swear by. You swear by me because I am, right, supreme, and that's the gold standard of I promise I'll do this. It's like saying, I swear on my mother's grave that, right? God says, I just swear by me because I'm me. that's his answer, right? So the idea would be don't say something that you're going to do. Don't say that, you know, you're going to do this thing or not do this thing based on me. So if you do it and you say it, James says, let your yes be a yes, your no be a no. That is what it means to defame God's name, okay? So to take it away, okay? So being men and women of integrity, to revere God properly in our language, okay? How about verse 8? This is a fourth commandment.
Or rested on the seventh day.
Okay, so the idea is you're going to take a day off. And what are you going to do on that day off?
Rest.
You're going to rest, okay, and do what else? You're going to worship me, okay? You're going to take a day off, and you're going to worship, okay? And again, this is fascinating to me. We talked about this when we were in Genesis. What is the example of work six, take a day off? What does God use as the example for that?
Creation.
That's how I did it. Okay, I built the world in 6 days and everything in it, and then I took a day off. Not because I was tired, but because I needed the rest. And I needed to show you the example of rest would probably be a better way to say that. Okay, so literal 6 days, right? So that's how Israel got that pattern. So it's very hard for me not to see a literal 7 day creation when God says, exactly like I did it, you do it. Work six, take a day off, rest, worship me. Get back to it on Monday, okay? Or in their case, Sunday, okay? Because their Sabbath is Saturday, all right? How about how you're going to treat your parents? Now we're going to begin to get into relationships. So now we're getting into the horizontal, okay? Verse 12. Tony, pick up there. Okay, so how do you handle your parents? With honor and respect. What if you don't like your parents? You honor them regardless, right? We're going to see today that there is a commandment that says if a kid curses his parents, he can be stoned to death. Can you imagine, right? You ever been to River Park, listen to kids talk to their parents, right, in public? You're like, oh, man, I would like that kid up. That kid needs, you know, he needs to get the wax out of his ears, and you just need to heat up his butt, so it all, right? That's how it was done in my house. My parents used to go make my brother and I choose the wooden spoon that they would use on one another. So, like, that's what we got spanked with, the wooden cooking spoon. So, and each of us chose the other one's weapon. So, it's like, how mad are we at each other? Are we going to be gracious? You know, are we getting, like, the big fat fraternity paddle? You know, so, yeah, my rear end got lit up a couple times, and it deserved it. So, okay, I earned that all on my own, okay? But that's the idea. Honor your parents, okay? How about verse 13? How are we to live life?
Do not murder.
Do not murder. Does God honor life? Yes, absolutely. Now, are there times in Scripture that God says, this is the time where you will take life? Absolutely. If you take another person's life, what happens to your life? We're going to take yours. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That didn't go away in the New Testament either. Okay, we're going to see that pattern, and we're going to see something today that will... you're going to see God's view on life, and you're going to see God's view on the unborn and how he views them. Are they life? Are they not life? Okay, so we'll see. So you can form all of your, abortion viewpoints today. Okay, you're welcome. How about verse 14? How do you handle other people's wives or husbands for that matter? Okay, your wife is your wife. Okay, have fun. Okay, don't. Have fun with other people's wives, I guess is the politically incorrect way to say it, okay? So there you go, all right? So honor your wife, okay? We're going to see more of that this morning in terms of how God views wives, okay? Even ones that are not yet married and how he would speak to those, okay? So you honor the spouse that you're with, okay? Verse 15, how about property? How do we handle that? Don't steal, okay? What's yours is yours, what's not yours is not yours, okay? There you go. So don't steal, right? Honor the people's property around you. How about verse 16? Let's look at the tongue. What does that mean? False testimony against your neighbor. Yeah, it's lying. Don't lie. Don't say your neighbor did X, Y, and Z when they didn't. Or if they did, you know, whatever. So the idea would be truthful in what comes out of your mouth. Okay, your relationship with your neighbor should be honest. Okay, so don't lie to better yourself or whatever. So don't bear false witness. Okay? And think about that in context of the law. What was one of the biggest questions that got asked of Jesus by the Pharisees? Who is my neighbor? And they wanted to whittle it down to this really, really small pocket of people, right? They're people that look like me and act like me. They have the same language as me. They have the same skin color as me. That's my neighbor. And what did Jesus do? He said, No. Your neighbor is everybody, like it or not. And they got hot mad at him for that. Okay, so Jesus says, No. Everyone is your neighbor. And to God, everyone's your neighbor. And we're going to see him use the example specifically today of how they treat foreigners, people that are not like them, And God's going to say, you knew what it was like to be in Egypt and be treated poorly. Don't you dare do that. He's going to command them not to be racist. Like, dang. Because they know what it was like to be oppressed by another group of people. And he says, that is forbidden in the law. You will not treat people different based on their socioeconomic status, their skin color, the language they speak, whatever it may be. Really?
Yeah. Hmm. I was talking to her about Fresno, like how she likes Fresno. She's like, yeah, it's more diverse. I don't get scared at
it. Yeah. Like, where's she from?
She's from South Korea.
Wow. We're somewhat diverse. It depends on where she's at. But yeah, it's different. Like,
she was in like a smaller, like a farm, more of a cave.
There you go. That would make sense. Yeah. And I remember going to Thailand and just feeling that really weird sense. And we were with seven, you know, white males, right, that were football players and such. We stood out. I didn't, but they stood out like sore thumbs. And everywhere we went, people stopped and pointed and laughed and said, Farong, Farong, Farong. And we were like, and there was a point where it was like, okay, it's funny. But then it's like literally everywhere we went. And I'd never been in the position where I was the sore thumb and kind of stood out. And Farong was like white honky, right? It was kind of PG-13. It was, you know, not inappropriate in their language, but it was like, ha, foreigner. That's basically what they were saying, and they're laughing at us, right? And it's like, okay, yes, because, you know, I'm pasty white and have whatever, right? So that's me. But it was odd being in a position where I was the one, and we were the ones that weren't, right? And that's, it's uncomfortable. And God's going to say, don't do that to people, okay? You treat them as if they were your brethren, because they are, okay? So fascinating, some of the stuff that's in here. And it's like, man, if society just listened to this and did it, it ain't rocket science, people, right? It's just people don't want to do this because it's difficult, okay? It takes, we'll see what it takes, okay? So don't steal, don't bear false witness, okay? How about the last one in verse 17? Okay, what does that mean? Be content, right? If your neighbor has a Lotus, then great. If your neighbor has a mansion, fantastic. And you don't, great. Okay, if your neighbor has this wife or that car or this ox or whatever, like, just you enjoy what God's given you and enjoy it. Don't covet, right? We live in a society where it's always the next best thing. Okay, we're all guilty of it in our own little ways, but that's the idea. God says, man, be content with what I give you. Don't worry about what I've given them. Worry about what I've given you and enjoy it, okay? So those are the Ten Commandments, right? Our religious life, our walk with God, the horizontal or the vertical relationship with Him, and then the horizontal relationship with others, okay? Honor me, put me first, okay? Honor the people around you, do them right, live by the golden rule. That's the idea, okay? Now the rest of these laws, they're going to get expanded on from here, okay? So that's the ten. And then the rest of them will kind of fall into those categories, and God's going to flesh those out with detail. And again, 613 commandments total of what they're to be. Okay, so that's the idea. All right? Now, let's pick up in chapter 21, and we're going to see now kind of the first fleshing out of some of these laws. Okay, this one is one of the coolest stories in your Old Testament. Okay, fascinating. So let's look at 21:1, and God's going to teach them how to deal with slaves. Okay, so now, again, different context in this day and age for slave. You had indentured servants, okay? This was like supposed to be more of like a hired butler or maid, but it's someone that worked for you, was there to take care of your family, okay? And you purchased them, okay? But what happens after 6 years? It's ollie-ollie oxen free, okay? You are free to go, okay? Now, the idea would be, based on what's occurring, you can see what the nature of this relationship was supposed to be, okay? Verse 3, if he came in alone, he shall go out alone. If he's the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears to him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall not go out alone. Okay, so there were rules with children and wives, and or wife as to what would happen. Okay, but after 6 years, if that slave said in verse 5, this was kind of the caveat to all of it. Jane, pick up there in 5.
Or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl.
So 6 years, the guy says, man, I've loved my time here. I'm free to go, but I don't want to go. And the master says, great. So you're committing yourself to this house for life, not under obligation, but under desire. And the slave would say, yes. So you went to the front door of the house, right? The same door that you would put the Passover lamb on. You would take your ear next to the door, and they would take an ice pick and run it through your ear, is to way to say, you are now part of this house, okay? There was a servant in the Old Testament, or a slave. This was different, okay? What is this person called in the Old Testament? A bond slave, or a bond servant. Have we heard that language used in the New Testament? Who uses that language? Paul, numerous times. A bond servant of Christ. He intros his letters. He could identify himself however he wants to, right? Jew among Jews, keeper of the law. Think of all the ways that Paul, the resume of words that he had to choose from to say, look, I'm Oxford educated, I'm Ivy League, I'm above all of you. How does he describe himself? A bond servant of Christ. I am a freed slave that has forever attached myself to the master because I love him and don't want to go anywhere. Okay, powerful language, and I think Paul is borrowing that from Exodus chapter 21. I'm a bond slave of Christ, and I would be nowhere else. Okay, so powerful imagery. Okay, so that's one of my favorites. All right, now 12 and following, laws concerning personal injury. You're going to see a theme with how God, what God expects of his people as you read these. And I just want you to take note of that, and we'll kind of bring it to the surface at the end. Okay, verse 12. Let's talk about murder. Yep.
Whoever strikes a man so that he dies should be put to death. But if he did not die, but if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hands, then I will anoint for you a place to which he may flee.
All right, so what is this idea? But if he did not, this guy strikes another man, and as a result, this other dude dies. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint a place for you to flee. What's that idea? I killed a dude, but what? I did not lie in wait for him. What does that mean? Yeah, okay, it was accidental. Like, dude, I accidentally hit this dude with my car. I didn't mean to do it. It wasn't premeditated, okay? It's second degree or manslaughter. God says then, okay, that's different. And he says he's going to apply or provide a place to which this person may flee. What are those places called in Israel? Cities of refuge, okay? There are three cities that you would go to, okay? Three on the west side of the Jordan, three on the east side of the Jordan, okay, that you could go to. And the idea was you're bound to those cities. You're kind of under house arrest, but you've got a city that you're arrested to, if you will, where no one can touch you, okay? Now, you can't leave that city, but you can take care of business, you can raise your family, but you're confined to that city until the high priest dies. And once the high priest dies, it's game over, or you know, start over, okay? You are free to, that family could take retribution upon you if they so desired, okay?
So were the cities of refuge only accidental murderers live there, or did other people live there?
Other people live there as well. So God would set those up and say, in addition to whatever city you are, you can be in these things. And he set them up with, like, literally, they're like north, central, south, okay? On the west side, north, central, south, you know, so you always had a place that you were close to, okay? So let's go back to verse 7, by the way. There's some good stuff in here, okay? I don't mean to just skip over that, sorry. But yeah, that was kind of the idea with that, okay? Verse 7, if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is to not go free as male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have the authority to sell her to a foreign people because he is because of his unfairness to her, okay? If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of the daughter. So the idea being, if you had a female slave in your house, you had certain rights as to the way you could deal with them, okay? But you had certain responsibilities as well as to what you could and could not do with a said female slave. And the idea at the end of the day was you had to care for her properly, okay? You couldn't just discard her. You couldn't do what you wanted to with it. But if that gal was born in your house as a result of slaves that you had purchased to live with you, then you had obligations to live up to on your end to take care of them, okay? Some of these we look at and go, man, that sounds harsh, okay? In comparison to what was maybe going on in their culture, this is very liberal, if you will. God is calling them to a higher standard. And today we'd say, we'd like a little higher, if you will. But anyway, that's kind of how it was. God was calling them to take care of them, okay? If in verse 10, he takes himself another woman, he may not reduce her food or clothing or her conjugal rights. If you had multiple wives, you could not, forgive the language, you couldn't treat one woman as property or a sex slave or whatever, you know, guys would think, right? You had to take care of her, you had to give her food, you had to give her property. So in a case like Jacob, and you've got two wives and two concubines, how were you told to treat the rest of your family? You had to take care of them. You couldn't just throw, you know, Bilhah out to the, you know, the wolves and say, good luck, right? You're, you know, ugly and cross-eyed. I don't want to hang out with you anymore. I've got, you know, Rachel now. God says, no. Okay, you're responsible for her. You take care of her. You raise a family for her. That's the idea, okay? So does that make sense? So, okay, different, obviously, than maybe how we would do things in our day and age, but God is commanding them to a higher standard of people are not property. You are to care for them. You are to take care of them. Okay, that's the idea. All right. So, back to murder. Okay, verse 14. Now we're no longer talking about non-premeditated murder. We're talking about a different kind. 14. Read that.
But if a man willfully attacks another and kills him by cunning, you shall take him from an altar and he may die.
So I don't care if the guy's in the midst of a worship service on an altar praying to me. You rip him off that altar and you kill him, okay? If it was a premeditated murder, my verse says, so to kill him craftily, like he thought about this, he had a plan, right? He drew pictures, I don't know. But the idea would be this is premeditated first-degree murder with ill intent. That guy's life is gone, okay? Verse 15, here's the fun verse that teenagers should read. He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Verse 17, he who curses his mother shall surely be put to death. Okay, so you lay a hand on mama, you're dead. You want to drop an F-bomb to mama, you can die as well. Okay, I mean, holy cow, would our society look different.
How awkward is this for Moses to be writing this, like, you know, about killing somebody.
And, right.
You know, like, you know. If
yeah,
them,
yeah. It brings us to a great question. Why? What was God's expectation of the law? He gives them 613 commandments. Was his expectation, by the way, Israel, you keep these? What was his expectation with that? For those of you that are parents, think from a parental standpoint, or for those of you that were raised in homes with good rules, what was your parents' expectation of you with those rules? Or what is your expectation of your kids with the rules that you set in your home? Do you expect your kids to be perfect, or were you expected to be perfect? No, right? Why were the rules there?
Protect
you. Okay, that's one of the reasons God sets this up. Okay, these are protect Israel. He's going to give them dietary laws. He's going to give them hygienic laws. Like, hey, people, right? Have clean houses. Don't be filthy. Okay, because when you're filthy, stuff grows in your homes, it's nasty, and you're going to die. So don't do that. Okay? By the way, when the bubonic plague came through Europe and whenever it came in, you history majors, the Jews were accused of starting the plague. You know why? Because they didn't get sick. You know why? Because they weren't filthy people. They were hygienic because the law said be hygienic. So oddly enough, those people didn't have rats and all the other things that began to infest the houses and the homes of these people. They weren't dying. So people said, ooh, it's their fault. Well, the reason was because they kept clean homes and they didn't deal with these things because God said, no, it's here. So it's to protect you, right? So do I expect all my kids to obey all my laws? No. Okay. What do I expect them to do when they break my laws? Yeah. Hold themselves accountable. Be repentant. Okay. Apologize and move on. Okay. Learn lessons. But those are there. Don't put your hand on the stove. Why? Because the downside is not near as good as the upside. Okay. I've done it. I'm your dad. Don't do it. It's a bad idea. Okay. Trust me. Okay. And we set up laws in our house for the same reason, okay? So one of the reasons God's given these laws is to say, listen, I don't expect you to keep them all. See also Moses, right? He's already out in like law one or two, whatever, you know, we're not supposed to murder, right? But the idea was these are going to protect you guys, okay? And that's obviously good for them to know that they don't have a perfect leader either, okay? By the way, if you just want to take a couple notes on that. The law was there, number one, to protect Israel. That's one of maybe four reasons. If you want to jot these down, you can. If not, don't worry about it, okay? Number two is to expose sin, okay? In Romans, what does Paul talk about in terms of the law? What did the law do for him specifically in Romans 7? He talks about the idea of when law came, he then realized what the standard was, and then he could set his life in relation to that standard. So he basically said, before the law, I did not know what sin was. Okay? Turn real quick. Someone reads Romans 7:7, if you can, while I'm talking. But Paul's commentary was, listen, before the law, I didn't know what sin was. Until you put the speed limit sign that says drive 55, I didn't know I was sinning when I was driving 65. Now I'm willfully sinning, and I know that I'm sinning because there is a standard. Okay, Jane, you got that?
Yeah. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I would not have known what sin was except through the law.
Okay, so that's Paul's argument. Okay, now that the law is there, I understand what sin is and what sin isn't, because God called a shot. He said, this is what is appropriate and what's not, okay? Their deal was saying, well, the law is sinful, okay? And Paul will get into that argument as you guys roll through Romans as well, okay? But it's not that, okay? Thirdly, it's going to point to Christ ultimately, right? Hey, here are all these laws. Guess what? You can't keep them. You're going to need a law keeper. You're going to need someone that can atone for the fact that you can't keep all these laws. This is the expectation to a degree. I don't expect you to be perfect. I expect you to be perfectible, but it's going to point to their need of realizing, man, we can't keep these laws. We cannot in ourselves do it, okay? Lastly, it taught true righteousness. If you're a son or a daughter of the king, could you do whatever the heck you wanted to? No, you still had to obey the laws, right? What does Paul say in Romans 6? Shall we continue to sin that grace may increase? It's a logical argument, right? If you have a super gracious God, and the more you sin, the more you get grace, if we're a child of that God, and we're going to get grace upon grace regardless, should we just continue to sin that grace may increase? What does Paul say? He says, heck no, right? He says, meganoita. Like, no, that's foolish. That's abusing the system. So true righteousness is, even though you are a son or you are a daughter, you obey out of a love for God, not because you have to, because you want to, because you love the Father, right? So that's the idea, all right? So there's some of the purposes of the law, all right? So expose sin, protect Israel, point to Christ, teaches true righteousness, okay? Make it a sense? All right. Good, good, good. All right, back to chapter 20, okay? One. My bad, all right? Let's see. 18 and following. This is pretty cool. If men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, okay, so verse 18, there's a bar fight, okay, one guy smacks another in the teeth, okay, and does not die but remains in bed, meaning he can't work, so now he's in the ER, okay, now he's in ICU. If he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished, okay, so if you didn't kill a guy, you got in a bar fight, it's both of your faults, you both had too much to drink, you're both stupid, okay, then if he walks around, you're not going to get punished. However, he only shall pay for the his loss of time, and he shall take care of him until he's completely healed. What does that mean? You smack a guy in the teeth, he can't go to work, and he has to go to the ER. Whose responsibility is it to take care of him? Yours. You pay his lost wages, you pay his deductible, you pay anything. Why? Because you did it. You hit him in the teeth, okay? That's not Blue Shield's responsibility. That's not the state of California's responsibility. It's your responsibility. You hit him in the teeth. You pay his minimum wage. You pay whatever wage he was earning and not being able to go back to work. And you pay his $500 deductible and x-rays and CAT scan and anything on top of that. Can you imagine if that's what our society looked like, right? What is that called? Personal responsibility. If you handle your body in such a way that it's not appropriate and it causes others harm, guess what? It's on you. What do you think you're going to do next time you're at a bar and have too much to drink and want to do something stupid? Oh. And that, yeah. I'm going to take one of the teeth. Right here, buddy. I got 5 days off and you had to pay my deductible. You're going to think twice about it, Pete. My goodness. Jeez. No more coffee for you, funny guy. Yeah. So you're going to think twice about stuff, right? And the whole rest of 21 is the exact same idea, okay? How about 22? Here's your verse on women in pregnancy and in life prior to the womb. Read 22.
When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fine, as the woman's husband shall throw nothing,
Okay, so you've got two guys fighting, okay? They hit a pregnant woman. My Bible says she has a miscarriage, and that translation's actually better, meaning her baby comes out prematurely. Alive, but premature. So not miscarry in our terms where you think the fetus is aborted and there's a dead child, okay, as a result. This is saying, no, she has the baby. The baby's not harmed. The baby's alive, okay? The end result is you're going to pay whatever the judges decide for said actions. However, verse 23, if there's any further injury, you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Okay? What does that mean? The baby dies, then what happens? The guy who started the fight dies. Why? Life for life. So tell me about God's view of life before it comes out of the womb. Is it alive? Yes. It's not an it. It's a he. It's a she. It's a life. It has a soul. God says that is life. Okay, even though it's not out of the womb yet, is it still alive? Absolutely, because God gave it life. Okay, so that person who started that fight and accidentally hit that pregnant woman at the bar as a result of getting smacked in the teeth, right? This is all at a bar. It's in Hebrew. Okay, I know you guys can't see that. That's my great education. Okay, whatever. Okay, but that's the idea. So you're going to treat it as if it's alive. Okay, so You see God's standard even there, okay, is raising the bar in terms of what life is and what's not, okay? How about this? Verse 28, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, that ox shall surely be stoned and its flesh shall be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished, okay? So if you've got an ox that gores a person, and this is the first time it's happened, okay? It's not a normative thing. You eat the ox, you burn it, right? Not in that order, okay? You kill it, eat it, right? But the owner goes unpunished, right? You got a pit bull that got out of its yard one time, killed somebody. It's probably a bad example. End result would be bad. But you kill the dog, okay? And if you want to eat it, knock yourself out. Whatever. I'm pretty sure in Thailand we eat lots of dogs, but that's another story, okay? That's popular in some parts of the world, okay? Not so much in America, okay? Now, how about 29? What if you got an ox that was previously in the habit of goring, okay? And its owner has been warned, meaning he's done this before. Okay, you've got an ox that likes to gore for whatever reason. Okay, he does not contain it and it kills a man or a woman. The ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death as well. So are you telling me not only are you responsible for you, but you're responsible for your property and the things that God has given you? And if your pit bull goes and bites a 2-year-old kid and kills that kid, and he's done that before, what happens to the pit bull? He dies, and what happens to you as the owner? You die. Come on. I mean, God is calling the people to take personal responsibility for what they have, okay? One time, hey, we get that. We all make mistakes. No biggie, right? Unfortunate circumstance, but you're not going to die, but we are going to kill your pit bull. If he's done this numerous times and you know better and you don't take responsibility for what God has given you, the dog dies and you die as well. It's as simple as that, okay? So, fascinating, okay? Verse 30, if a ransom is demanded of him, the person whose ox was killed, he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Okay, so you pay whatever is demanded by the person who you killed. Okay, whether it was a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. Verse 32, if the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So if that ox kills a servant, you kill the ox and you pay the owner 30 shekels of silver. That ring a bell anywhere in the New Testament? 30 shekels of silver. That's what Jesus was sold for, okay? The price of a gored slave is what Judas was paid by the Romans to give him up, okay? 30 shekels of silver. Sad, okay? More on that on 33 and following. If a man digs a pit, leaves it open, someone falls in, man, that's on you. You're gonna be held responsible for the stuff that you have, the holes that you dig, for whatever you do, whether you're there, whether you're not there, you take responsibility, okay? 22, how about theft? If a man steals an ox or a sheep or slaughters it and sells it, he will pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. So if you steal someone's sheep, what do you pay them in return? 4 or 5 times what you took. So if you steal a hundo, what are you paying back? 5 hundo. Okay, that's the law. Okay, how about Zacchaeus in Luke 19, okay? When he found out, when he had his interaction with Christ and realized, man, I'm a tax collector, I've been doing people wrong, what did he go and do? He went and paid people back. How much? 4 or 5 times, I forget what the scripture says. Where did he get that idea? Because that's what the law said. He said, well, that's what my responsibility is in, right? So, fascinating, okay? That's cool, okay? 2, this is a great law. 22:2.
The thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies. There will be no blood guiltiness on his account.
Okay, so if you're breaking into someone's house and you beat that guy up and kill him, are you guilty? No. You shoot that guy because he's coming in your house. Okay? Are you guilty? No. Okay? There's a Texas law, literally, that says if somebody's breaking into your home and you shoot them, okay, if that person is in your house, you're good. If that person is outside of your house, you're no good. Okay? So the idea is if you're going to have a gun in Texas and you shoot someone, you shoot them and then you drag them into your home before the cops get there. Okay? That's the distinction, right? So yeah, be very careful. Wait, no, keep coming. All the way through the door, buddy. Bang! Right? So, yeah. Anyway, so it's a funny law in Texas. But that's the divide. Is he inside or is he outside? Or she, for that matter. Okay? So, yeah. So don't break into anyone's house. Or if you do, make sure you fall on the outside. Or shoot someone when they're inside of your house. However you want to interpret that. Whatever side of the bullet you want to be on. Okay? That's the idea. Okay? Yeah. There you go. Yeah. God apparently is not a pacifist. So just, tough. If the sun has risen on him and there will be blood guiltless on his account, in verse 3, you shall surely make restitution, meaning if it's over, like you don't have the right to shoot him anymore, don't shoot him. He shall surely make restitution. He'll pay you back for what he stole. Like if this is, you know, weeks later and you find out, okay, he's going to take responsibility for his stuff, okay? Verse 5, if a man lets his field or his vineyard be grazed bare and lets the animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, right? You didn't take care of your property, and now your animal got in another guy's field and grazes it bare. He shall make restitution of the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. Take care of your ox. Build a better fence, right? Take care of your stuff, okay? If a fire breaks out so that the stacked grain or the standing grain, verse 6, on the field is consumed, he who started the fire shall make restitution, right? If you didn't take care of your land, and as a result, fire started on your land and went to your neighbor's land, guess what? You got to make restitution to your neighbor because you're dumb, okay? And you're not taking care of your stuff, okay? So much of this law is simply about taking personal responsibility, okay? That's the idea of the law. And God holds them to that standard. And when they're held to that standard, they realize, man, I need to be concerned about this. This matters, how I treat myself, how I treat others, how I treat my ox, how I handle my stuff when I dig a hole, and you know, it's all of it matters, okay? And I think some of that in our society, we've just lost that idea of personal responsibility. It's someone else's fault, someone else's responsibility. So the core of the laws with interactions between humans is, listen, that's the idea. Take responsibility for your stuff, okay? Thieves and such in verse 7 and following. Sorry, I'm trying to move through these because I want to get the last part of our time to the tabernacle and stuff. 14 and following, you get stuff about borrowing, okay, and making sure you take care of stuff that you borrow. Verse 16 of chapter 22, read that. 16 and 17, this is on what happens with premarital sex. Okay, so you sleep with a single gal who's not engaged, what do you have to do? You just married her. Congratulations. She's your wife because you just had sex. Okay? That's how God views sex. So you pay the dowry. Now, your father says, you're a scumbag. Okay? 17, keep going.
If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins.
What does that mean? Dowry equal to the, or money equal to the dowry of virgins. That means dad gets to say, you're going to write me a blank check, and I'm going to fill it in with whatever I want to. Because that's my daughter, who's a virgin that you just slept with. What do you think dad's going to ask for? The moon, right? That's the idea. So, but the idea is you're going to take care of her. Okay, that's your wife. Because you just slept with another man's wife, she's now your wife. Okay, you're gonna provide for her properly. And if your dad says, no, you're a scumbag, I'm not giving this wonderful gal to you, you're going to pay whatever I ask. And there's no judge or jury. Whatever I say is the amount that you're going to pay to the angry father, right? Woo! So don't do it, okay? Let's see. What's that?
We meet a lot of
Or there'd be a lot of guys that, lots of inappropriate, yeah, ways to say that in my head right now. There'd be a lot of guys that would take responsibility for their actions. Or you'd learn pretty quick, right? Or you'd see a broke guy and go, what'd you do? Oh, well, you know, it was great for 15 minutes and now I got to pay for it the rest of my life. Like, yeah, that was pretty stupid. Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
So even if they wanted to take responsibility, they sometimes
could. Well, they're going to take responsibility one way or the other, right? They're going to pay up. It's just a matter of if the dad says no, we're going to go ahead and hold out and find my wife or my daughter a better husband, okay? This is cool. Verse 21, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So God reminds them, and we're going to see that several places in the law, but you do not treat them differently just because they're different than you. You shall not afflict a widow or an orphan if you afflict them at all. And I hear, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry. Okay, just like Hagar in the wilderness, this little old woman who nobody knows, God says, I hear that voice. The widow, the orphan, those that you put on the outside, I hear their voice. I care, so you're going to care. Okay. Verse 25, if you loan money to your people, no interest, okay? So Jane's broke and I give her 50 bucks, I can't charge her interest because she's my sister, okay? That's the idea. So you don't get to exact usury on people. Nehemiah lost his mind on this when brothers and sisters were charging each other interest within Israel, and he said, how dare you? Do not do that.
Sorry about this, but in verse 18, it says you
should
not
try to source your sword. The occult, witches, other people outside of Israel, hopefully, that were practicing other forms of idol worship. If that got into Israel and people were practicing that, death. So you did not get to worship false gods. And God says, I take that very seriously. So.
I think like the sorcerers that were in Egypt. Like
yeah, they would have been similar to that. That would have been their frame of reference for sure, the magicians of Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Let's see. How about this one? Verse 28. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. Who would that be in context? The ruler of your people in our context. Anybody. Anybody that God's put in authority in government. Okay? Like it or not, man, you know what? We probably all have opinions that nobody cares about. But we do not curse them. All right? Man, for all the dislike or like or whatever, man, I tell you what, I would not want that job. You don't make anybody happy, okay? So that's tough, okay? So God says ultimately in Romans 13, all government is established by me. So don't curse them because I put them there, okay? That's the ultimate why, okay? Let's see, 23, kind of more of the same. In 10 and following, you're going to see kind of their travel holiday schedule, if you will. Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Harvest, or Pentecost as we cover it now, and then In Gathering, the Feast of Booths. Those were the three travel days where all males had to return to Israel, specifically to Jerusalem, sorry, not Israel, but Jerusalem, to worship God. Okay, so he sets that up in 23 and following. Okay, so that's the idea there, all right? Let's go to the tabernacle, okay? So if you look at chapter 25, so we'll see some more of these laws as we get into Deuteronomy and roll through them in greater detail. In 25 now, God is going to set up this idea of the tabernacle, okay? And this place where God is going to be worshipped. So he's going to formally set up this building. In Leviticus, he's going to say, now that we have this building, here's how you're going to worship me. Here are the ways that we're going to go about using this place for kind of my purpose, okay? 25, 1 and 2, pick up there, let's read that.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel to cut the Levites. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution.
So how's the tabernacle going to be built? Yeah, everyone's going to step up and give, right? It's kind of a cool concept. And it'll say in here multiple times, Moses would give a speech, people will feel compelled to give, and they'd say, man, that's awesome. I've got curtains, or I've got materials to build these pillars, or I've got gold, and they gave. And that's how the tabernacle came together. Okay, it's one of the reasons why a lot of churches will kind of go back to that idea of, man, that's how we need to build a building. Okay, we don't need to go into gazillions of dollars of debt. We need to allow the people to give from above and beyond. And you're going to see at the end of this, they brought too much. Moses had to say, we're done, okay? Thank you. You guys have been extremely generous. We have more than enough, okay? It's fascinating, okay? So that's the idea. So everyone's going to contribute what they have, and you go through here. As you just look at maybe some of the chapter headings in your Bible, above 10, mine says the ark and the mercy seat, 23, the table and the lampstand. You see all these elements that are in there, okay? And we'll look at that this morning, okay? So let's just watch, and you guys can kind of get an idea of what's what, okay? So this is the tabernacle, okay? This is what ultimately they would have built. This is what it would have looked like, okay? Okay? So, completely mobile, okay? You guys can get an idea of the scale of it. American football field is at the right corner. That would have been to scale, okay? So that's the idea. And then the tabernacle would have been the actual size kind of underneath that, okay? Does that make sense? So a quarter of a football field is what would have taken up, okay? This was designed to be completely portable. Okay, they could move it at any time. In Numbers 33, we're going to see the whole journey that they take all through the wilderness. They basically pack up shop 42 times in 40 years. So on average, they move once a year. Now, God didn't move every year. It was kind of whenever he said, again, the pillar of the fire, the cloud, and that sort of thing. Okay? So that was the idea. Okay. Before I forget, at Melissa's request, you guys charts. I printed them out and everything. Okay. Here is a overview you guys to take with you. There is one mistake on that. For whatever reason, when you get at the top left-hand corner, I gave you the dimensions, and it says faces south. This faced east. I don't know where I got south. Okay. But the door to come into the tabernacle would have faced east. Okay. So always east. All right. And then Israel would have camped around it. Okay. So in here, you kind of see the elements, okay? So outside, this is where the offerers would come in, okay? This is obviously the realm of the priest, but you would bring in your offering, okay? You would slaughter it on these tables or what have you, and then the meat from that slaughter would go on the altar, okay? And the priest would take part of all this, okay? It's neat to see as the text unfolds, it was the offerer's responsibility, according to the book of Leviticus, to slay the animal, to cut the animal up into pieces, okay, and to offer these things, okay? Now, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit in terms of the offerings, but what was the symbolism and the picture behind that? Why would you bring all these offerings for the priest to kill and put on the altar and all these things? What was the purpose?
To show the disobedience brings death, separating.
Yeah, so when you broke the law, there was a penalty for that. So God says, I don't expect you to keep it. So as soon as he gives the law, the book of Leviticus, he says, here's how you fix it when you break it. You offer these things. And it's serious. It costs you something, right? So you would have seen this idea of substitutionary atonement. You would have seen the idea of, yeah, there's a penalty, there's shed blood, okay? And it was the offerer's job to do all that, okay? The priest would work in here. This is where the animal would get literally cooked, okay? So you would put the animal on this fire. And then you would cleanse yourself, and the priest would on the laver. Okay, these are like big tables of water. They're all over Israel. But you would cleanse yourself ceremonially before you went in. Only the priest went past this part. The offerer could be out here. Any Israelite could be out here. Inside this first, this is called the holy place. And the backside is called the Holy of Holies. In here, that's where the priest went. Okay. Inside of that, there were kind of three different elements, as you can see. As you walked into your left, number five was the lampstand. Okay, that represented God. It was the light, the menorah, as we're familiar with. Okay. It would have been lit continually by the priest. It was always on. It was the priest's duty to kind of maintain all these things. The altar of incense in verse 4, God's going to give literally like a chapter's worth of a baking recipe. This is what the holy place will smell like. And no one else can smell like this, okay? Jane can't wear that perfume. This is mine. And he says literally, it's like, this is my essence, right? That God says, when you walk into the holy place, you're going to smell, first of all, burnt flesh, okay? You guys ever smell burnt hair or burnt flesh? It's horrible, but it's very potent, right? You know it when you smell it. Oh, gosh. But God says that when you smell that, you're going to think of an offering to God. That is a pleasing smell to God, okay? And then inside the holy place, there was literally like chocolate chip cookies. The smell of those, that's mine. No one else can have that smell because that's the smell of worship, and God's serious about it, okay? So there would have been incense and that sort of thing going on in verse 4, in location 4.
And seven, that was the table of showbread. That was the presence of God. There literally would have been bread put on that table to symbolize the bread of life and God's kind of presence there. Okay? And then once a year, the high priest would go into this place, which is where the Ark of the Covenant was. There was a veil that separated the two. That was the Holy of Holies. Okay? And we'll get into that in the book of Leviticus. Okay? Make sense? Okay? Outside were the, you know, the portable structure, the tent itself, pillars and frames and all the stuff. This stuff, by the way, in here, these pillars are made out of pure gold. So it was nice, but it was a tent. Okay? So, but God gave us very clear instructions as to what that's going to look like. Okay? Here's what it would have looked like in the camp. Okay? So if you were in Israel and around, they had a camp around the tabernacle. That was the central focal point of the whole camp of Israel. Why the center? What was God communicating? Yeah. His presence and his desire to be with his people, right? So I'm the focal point of all of it, okay? Moses and the priests would hang out here. Okay, they were right next to the camp, okay? And the Kohathites were one of the families that we'll study later of Moses. The Merarites up there, and then the Gershonites there, okay? So they kind of had the closest proximity to the tent, and then everyone else camped in a certain location, right? This wasn't like drive up the Shaver and pick whatever spot's free. It's like, no, your family, if you are Dan, you camp here every time. Okay, that's the idea. Okay? Make sense? Here's what, again, just to kind of give you a bit of a size comparison. Ezekiel's temple is the one that's going to be built later. We haven't seen that. That's end time stuff in future. Herod's temple here is what we're going to go see when we go to Israel, the remnants of that. So Herod took the tabernacle, ultimately becomes the temple. We have the first temple built that's Solomon's, okay, which is like magnificent and beautiful. Wasn't huge, but it was ornate. Okay, Solomon said, I've got a blank checkbook, so I'm going to use it. And that's how he built the temple. Okay, that gets destroyed, right? You guys know that story in 586 when the Babylonians come in. That gets destroyed. They build a new temple after the fact when they come in after the exile, which is basically now Herod's temple. So they build this place. Herod makes it bigger and better and yada, yada, yada. Okay. Now, thankfully, when Moses built this temple, he was nice enough to take photos of it, and he did. Okay, so here's what it looked like. The tabernacle was actually there. Okay, in Israel, there is a place north of Eilat. You guys remember the vacation hotspot that I told you about on the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba? Doesn't matter. Anyway, this is in Timnah. We can't go there because it would take an entire day just to go see this site. It's a cool site, but not cool enough to waste a whole day on. They have a tabernacle model to scale. Exactly what it would have looked like in terms of size, dimensions. They didn't use gold and silver and all the really cool stuff that, for obvious reasons, okay? But this Christian organization set this up, okay? So you can kind of see what it would have looked like. And they probably would have camped at one of their campsites probably 3 miles away from this place. So this is like the terrain and everything, this is what it would have looked like. Tabernacle in the middle, the people would have been all around, okay? There's the idea of a close-up, okay? You can see the altar in the kind of the foreground there on the left, okay, that would have been, is this working? Nope. So that's where, again, where the animals would have been burned. You see the four horns on the altar, the laver, and then the entrance into the tent itself, okay? That's kind of the idea. So pretty ornate, pretty cool. This is what the structure would have looked like, colors and everything, okay? Inside, okay, these freaky mannequins, so weird, but anyway. But there's the menorah, okay? So you walk in on the left. You've got the lampstand, the menorah, the symbol of the presence of God. You've got the altar of incense at the front, right? As you walk into the holy place, in the front of them, this would have been the altar of incense. So this is would have been where, like, the priests would have taken the ashes from the altar that's outside with a shovel, brought them into this room, and they would have made their perfume, basically, their aroma offering to God. This was always burning. The altar of incense always had incense burning on it, okay? That's the idea. So that's where that would have been placed, okay? And then the table of showbread, again, was just the presence of God, okay? There was always, this was made of pure gold as well and had bread on it to symbolize, you know, God's presence, okay? So those were the three things in the holy place. And then inside, this is the Holy of Holies, okay? So you kind of see one of the tour groups in here from previous years. But it was small, okay? It contained the Ark of the Covenant on the left, two cherubim. This thing was built in solid gold. And God said that he would dwell above the Ark of the Covenant, okay? This lid right here that the I'm pulling it, you can see it. The lid here, okay, is made out of solid gold, okay? God would literally dwell above that. So the Shekinah glory, the cloud by day, fire by night, was literally present over that. And then outside of the tabernacle, you could see the presence of God. He would be physically there in the camp, okay? Underneath that were the broken tablets of Moses, right? Ultimately, those, the Ten Commandments that he got were broken. And then the jar of manna and Aaron's staff that's going to bud, okay? And what the priests would do on the Day of Atonement, we'll talk about that a little bit later, is they would put the blood on the mercy seat, the lid of the altar, or the Ark of the Covenant, okay? And basically what it was is you have God, you have the broken law, and in between God and the broken law, what do you have? The shed blood of an animal. So when God sees the law that was broken by Israel, what does he see it through? The shed blood, the atonement of another, okay? So it's not that the breaking of the law goes away, but he is able to see it as forgiven because there was a go-between. There was an atonement for that, okay? So that's the book of Leviticus. We'll look at that, okay? So here's the ark, kind of a close-up view of that. You got the cherubim and their wings built, again, to specifications. This is how big it would have been. This was the Ark of the Covenant. You notice that it has poles on it, and the way they were to carry it, it was very specific. God even tells them, you'll carry it this way. Here's who touches it. Here's who doesn't touch it. Don't touch it. Touch it by the pole. I mean, it's crazy detail. Again, 25 to 40 of Exodus is all about building this structure, okay? There are the Ten Commandments. Okay, these are not broken for whatever reason. They look to be intact. Apparently, they fixed them. That's the manna, I guess. I haven't eaten any, but apparently that's what it looks like. And then, you know, a recreation of the staff that budded, okay? So that's what it would have been inside of the Ark of the Covenant, okay? So, make sense? There you go. So there is our, we'll go back to that, okay? Here. Okay, so that's kind of the idea of the thing that they're going to build, okay? This is going to be church. This is going to be their life, right? This was God's system of how they're going to worship. So he is now going to formally set up the idea of this is how you will worship me, okay? This is the offerings and all that stuff. So Exodus, Leviticus, two whole books, and then the review of all that in Deuteronomy are basically for Israel's relationship with God, how they worship, what they do when they break laws, and how all that works, okay? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yep. And God, again, like Exodus is going to be about that. We're going to get like 10 chapters in Numbers as to how they break it down and move.
So how would they take the Ark of the Covenant out?
Hold that question. I'll show you when we get there. But it's okay. Very specific. There's an order. There's a family. There's a, you do this and then you do this. One family does, I mean, it's crazy detailed. So the idea is, again, the law of proportion in Scripture. Do you think this matters to God? Yeah, right? It's a big deal, okay? And you're going to see how much it matters to God. We're going to get a Ananias and Sapphira-type story in Scripture when they don't do it right. And God says, I'm not screwing around, okay? This is serious. This is your worship of me. You don't get to do it however you want to, okay? This is not a bicycle wheel and there's many ways to me, they're all spokes, and you can get to me however you want to. God says, no, there is one way, there's a small gate, you come through it, this is what worship for me looks like, and if you do it wrong, this is the consequence, okay? So he wants to be seen as holy and set apart, but available, okay? So kind of fascinating. All right, Kamos, questions on that? Just want you guys to have a feel for what this would have looked like in Israel, okay? That's the idea. Way faster than I anticipated, okay? So, all right, let's keep moving. We're going to skip a bunch of this stuff. All again, 25 and onward is all about the tabernacle. Look at 28. Does anybody have a chapter heading on 28? What's that about? Yeah, so how about that? God even tells the priest, this is what you're going to wear, okay? Someone has to sew this for you. You're going to wear this, and everything on the priest was symbolic, okay? He had a breastplate that had 12 jewels on it that literally stood for each tribe of Israel. He had a head garment that he would wear. I mean, Aaron had to be decked out a certain way. He had to take a bath beforehand. I mean, it was Everything about how this went down is ordered in Exodus. Okay, so from what he wore to how he interacted to how he got right with God first before he could minister to the people. Fascinating. Okay, so 28 is all about that. 29 is about how we're going to get the priests ready to do their job. So the problem is you got a sinful priest trying to make atonement for sinful people. Well, in God's economy, that doesn't work, right? Our priest, ultimately, in Jesus, is perfect. He doesn't need to be cleansed, but these priests do. So before they can minister, they have to get right as well, and that's 29.
Who's allowed in the tents around the tabernacle?
Around?
Where they have the altar and the
courtyard. In the courtyard? I think it's male Israelites only. I don't think females were in there because the male brought the sacrifice for the family. So yeah, I think it's guys only. With the temple model, there's a place set out for called the court of the Gentiles and the court of women where they could come into a certain place. Then it was, okay, male Jews only, okay, only priest, okay, only the high priest once a year. So there's it's sectioned off in that regard. Okay, so, yep, good question. Okay, so turn all the way to chapter 32. Okay, God has given now this description. This is what we're going to build. They haven't built it yet, but he's now given the blueprints for, what, seven chapters, something like that. In 32, we're going to see an oops. Okay, pick up in 32:1, and let's kind of just quickly move through this story. Okay, hold on real quick. So Moses has been up the hill 40 days, right? So he's been on top of Mount Sinai for 40 days getting these instructions, okay? That's a long time, like a couple days, maybe a week. You're like, dude, where did Moses go? So now they're looking at Aaron saying, dude, he's been gone like a month and a half. Like, what do we do? Aaron, you're number two. Build us a God that we can worship, okay? That's their knee-jerk response, right? And Aaron's like, okay. Not yet. They've been given to, they've gotten the Ten Commandments, and they've responded to that and said, yeah, we're going to do that. That's awesome. So they've done that.
Is there significance between them saying that Moses brought them out of Egypt and God saying, I brought you out of Egypt?
You see that interplay often, yeah. And Moses is going to remind God of that. God's going to call them Moses' people. And God says, and Moses says, no, they're your people, okay? You brought them out of Egypt. Like, he almost gives Moses a little something to say, are you going to take the bait on this? And Moses says, no. I did nothing. You're the guy.
Would God still be in the pillar of fire?
Yeah, there would have been something going on top of the mountain that would have been one of the reasons they believe that Mount Jebel Mosa, or whatever it's called, the Mount of Moses, as they call it, is because it's scorched on the top. It's one of the locations. And like, how did that happen? Like, because there was burning fire for 40 days, right? So yeah, it's hot rocks. So anyway, okay.
I think we talked about it earlier, that like they got the Ten Commandments, hoorah, and then they asked Moses, can you go up? Because like, we're afraid God's voice
on that, like, separation. Yeah, and he makes the people stay back. They're not allowed to go up. They have literally, Moses built like a perimeter around the mountain and said, don't cross this. Anyone crosses it is going to die. And they don't. But God's basically saying, I take this serious. Moses can go up. Aaron can go so far. The priest can come to the base. But Moses is the only guy that comes up with me. Yeah, so he's going to come down in a second, and this is where they get broken, okay, in 32. He goes up, God says, go back down, warn the people about how serious this is, goes back up, gets the Ten Commandments, and he's been up there ever since. 32, he's going to come down 40 days later with the Ten Commandments.
How did the people get the Ten Commandments?
I think he's telling them about, I'm not sure the exact order of operations, but this is, apparently, according to 19, they have knowledge of what's going to happen, or at least to some degree what's going to happen. They don't have the entirety of the law. So anyway, so yeah, figure that one out. All right, so Aaron says, great, everybody get your earrings, throw them in a pile, let's go ahead and make a god for you. And that's what he does. So Aaron, man, You can tell he's kind of lost a bit of faith as well. He doesn't know what to do, okay? Verse 3, they tore off their earrings, gave them to Aaron. He took from their hand, verse 4, fashioned into a graving tool, made it into a molten calf, and they said, "This is our God, O Israel, who brought us out of the land of Egypt." It's like, wait a second. God started this whole story with this contract. I am God who brought you out of Egypt. And they're saying, no, this is the God that brought us out of Egypt. I mean, they are thumbing their nose at God in a major way, and God's like, mm-mm, we ain't having that, okay? So Aaron saw this, built an altar before the Lord, or built an altar before it, I should say, and now he says we're going to have a feast. Verse 6, they bring in burnt offerings and peace offerings, right? All these things that sound really religious, right? Burnt offerings and peace offerings. We're going to see all those in Leviticus. Those are all good things, but he's offering to a golden rock that they made into a cow, you know, that they're worshiping. So it's the right actions externally with the wrong heart, okay, and the wrong thing. God says, no, okay? Notice this in verse 6, kind of some interesting language. Offer burnt offerings and peace offerings. The people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. That word play has a very sexual overtone to it. So they are worshiping God as the people around them worshiped their gods. They learned this in Egypt, and they're going to learn even more walking throughout the land. Okay, so this was... they have a feast, and they bring out a little too much vino. And then they say, let's have a different kind of party, okay? And that was very typical of false idol worship in Israel, okay? So when you worry or wonder about why people would want to worship false gods, this is what they were doing. We eat, we drink, we have a ginormous party. Oh, you guys are hungry and thirsty and wandering around in the wilderness. They're like, heck yeah, we want that, right? It meant all of their physical and sensual desires, that's what they wanted, okay? So it was a huge temptation for Israel, okay? So now God speaks up in verse 7 and says, go down at once, your people who you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. So notice how God responds to Moses, okay? They have turned away, they built a molten calf. The Lord says to Moses, I have seen this people. Behold, verse 9, they are obstinate. Now let me alone. My anger will burn against them, and I will destroy them, and I will make you a great nation. God says, I'll toast them all right now, Moses. We'll start over, okay? Whether God meant that or not, I don't know. But it's fascinating to me that he offers that to Moses. How are you going to respond, Moses? Okay? And he responds like you would hope that Moses would, okay? So God is angry, right? They're in the middle of giving these commands. This isn't, you know, it's sad that this is their response immediately. Okay, verse 11, Dave, pick up there.
But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power?
Interesting. The people said, it's the calf. Moses, or God says to Moses, you did it. And Moses says to God, no, you're the guy. Okay, so good job, Moses. Keep going. Okay, stop there. So who does he mention in verse 12? Okay, what's one of the reasons he says, God, you need to change your mind? Egypt. Why? They're going to laugh at you. God, your reputation is at stake. Okay, not mine. I didn't bring the people out of Egypt. You did. The pagan nations are going to laugh at Israel's God, and that's not okay. Remember your promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Relent. Okay, so Moses, man, what a champ. I love this guy, right? He is godly, doesn't take any responsibility in terms of the credit. He gives it all to God and says, God, your reputation is at stake. Now, Moses the whole time, everyone accuses Moses of doing wrong, right? He gets the blame, but yet he's not focused on that, okay? Verse 14, God changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people, okay? It smacks of Genesis 6 language in the flood where God says, he was sorry that he had made the people. He changed his mind. So within God's will, God has the ability to change course and to do different things that still fits within his will. So God decides to be merciful. He could have been unmerciful. He had every right to be. But he says, you know what? No. Okay. Moses stands up and says, let's not do this. 15, Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets. Okay, so these are the tablets that he had. Tablets which were written on both sides. They were written one side and the other. I think it's, in context, why is it mentioned that the tablets are written on both sides? It's like 1, 2, 3 on one side, 4, 5, and 6, and then God flipped it over and wrote 7, 8, 9. The idea is it's 1 through 5 or whatever, but there's one copy on Five Commandments and Five Commandments on the front side, and then what's on the back side? The exact same thing. Why is that significant? Where's God's copy? It's on the other side, with Moses, with the people, right? Remember the special place that you kept your copy of the contract? God says to Moses, go take that down the hill. Okay, I'm not positive on that, but I think that's kind of the meaning of the text, that God says, no, my copy's with you. I'm in the middle of the camp. I want to dwell in the midst of my people. That's my special place. You keep my copy of the contract with you. Okay, so that's the idea, all right? So they go down the hill. Moses, in verse 19, sees what they're doing. His anger burned. He threw the tablets down of his hands. They shattered them on the foot of the mountain. So 19, he gets mad. He took the calf, verse 20, which they had made, burned it with fire, ground it with powder, scattered it over the face of the earth, and made the sons of Israel drink it. Now, this is hilarious to me, okay? Why does Moses do that? Take the calf, grind it up, put it in a drink, drink it to everyone in Israel. Why does he do that? What do you do after you drink something? You pee it out. So what is Moses saying about the value of idols in our life? That's just what, right? It's like Rebecca. Oh, I'm sorry, this idol is under me. Oh, by the way, it's my time of month. That is the value of an idol. I mean, I think Moses could have done that a lot of ways. I think that's God's sense of humor, okay? That is the value of an idol to God. It's a piece of wood that you could burn in a fireplace one day, and now you're going to worship it? It's useless, right? It's not even worth being peed out of your body. Like, that's the value it has, right? So, fascinating, okay? Aaron's response is equally as bad. What do these people do to you in verse 21 that you brought such great sin upon them? Don't let, verse 22, your anger burn. You know these people are prone to evil. Verse 23, they said, make us a god who will go before us. We don't know where Moses is. I said in verse 24, get some gold. So they gave it to me. I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. It's like, no, dude, you fashioned this into a calf. It's just funny how Aaron won't take responsibility. So he kind of passes the buck to the people. Moses saw verse 25, the people were out of control. He draws a line in the sand in verse 26. He says, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. So whoever is on God's side, look at who responds. End of verse 26, when Moses draws a line in the sand and says, who's on my team? The Levites, okay? Watch what their first act is as priest. 27, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man, you put his sword upon his thigh, go back and forth from the gate to gate in the camp and kill every man, his brother, and every man, his friend, and every man, his neighbor. Meaning, if they partook in the worship of this false god, Levites, gird your sword and go kill your brothers. How serious does God take his worship? Seriously, right? I mean, that's scary. Correct. I think we get a number, verse 28, there it is. 3,000 men of the people fell that day. That's just the men. Okay, so obviously they were with the nature of the party that they had, women as well, but the men take responsibility. So the Levites have to go kill their brothers who were worshiping false gods in the midst of this. So, okay, Levi, in the midst of this, makes a name for himself because he says, we weren't a part of this. Uh-uh, we are on Moses' team. I think the majority were barking, but it was only the 3,000 that were actively engaging in this. But I don't think there was many that obviously stood up and said, we don't want to be a part of this. Obviously, the Levites weren't, because they come to Moses' aid, okay? So, anyway, so that's the rest of the deal, okay? Let's stop there. We'll pick up on the rest tomorrow. We're over, and I want to, the last part of this is pretty fascinating, so, okay? So, welcome to the giving of the law and the obstinance of this people. Right on the heels of the law, they're, woohoo, we want to obey you. Oh, get a calf, right? That's the people. This is that generation, okay? Not, no. Yeah, he gets it later to a degree, but he's going to get benched for a little bit, so we're going to see God deal with him. But God was merciful, I guess, to Aaron. Could have killed him. But again, it shows the issues with their leaders, right? You got a murderer with Aaron or with Moses. You got your first high priest that, and he's a debacle to some degree, right? He led this rebellion. God's still going to let him lead, so.